Hello, and welcome to The Trumpet, the official podcast of Elephant Room Productions. As always, I am your host, Robert Gene Pellecchio, talking today with playwright Martin Corin about his most recent year's experience. Martin, thank you so much for coming on today.
Oh, you're welcome, and thank you for having me.
Now, as Martin and I discussed before this call, we have a certain challenge for The Trumpet that has been completely avoided. I won't have to worry about the background noise of my air conditioner because I am recording this in an air conditionerless house at the moment. So if I am anything less than cognizant, it is because of that, but I have a venti cup of water next to me, filled with ice to hopefully ford me through. I've faced worse challenges, so hopefully this should be fine.
Well, whatever I can do to help Robert, let me know.
If you could get that repairman to come back sooner. But in the meantime, we'll go on our normal discussion journey that we always go on. But I do want to point out something really unique about this experience, and we will focus more on it later in the conversation when we get to Martin's play. But we realized that the play that we featured this month, Three Plays for America, or I should say last month, was, I believe, our 52nd or 53rd piece that was read for ears. But it was the first time in 2.5 years of doing the Elephant Ears reading series that we were privileged enough to have the playwright in the room with us for the feedback and to actually take notes and observe the reading. And that's something I'm very excited to talk about when we get there. But before we do, Martin, could you just kind of introduce yourself and kind of where you fit into the world of theater, your whole journey?
Sure. Well, I've been writing plays for a little over 20 years. And in fact, it took a good 20 years to write my first 10 plays. This was really a period of exploration and discovery. And I focused on basically realistic contemporary dramas focused on aspects of my own life, family, relationships, friendships, marriage, my working life, etc. During that time, I also wrote three plays that were responses to classic works of literature. And of all the plays that I wrote, those were the only three that really garnered any type of professional response, positive professional response. I had plenty of professional response for the other plays, but it wasn't necessarily positive. So that led me to understand some of my strengths and weaknesses as a writer. And I ended up writing my next 10 plays in 2 years, 7 plays the first year and then 3 plays last year. And, you know, I'm aware that it's a lot. And, it's striking to me that I hit this vein of creativity that worked right into what I discovered as some real strengths in my writing and staying away from some of the drawbacks of my style. So that's been my experience the last 2 years. The last play of these 10 plays that I wrote over the last 2 years, I wrote after speaking with a gentleman named Gabriel Green, who is the director of artistic development at La Jolla Playhouse. He's been, very kind to read my work and provide feedback. And what he said to me, especially through our email correspondence, was that my work has many, many strengths, but many theaters these days are looking for plays that directly confront what he termed the social and political situation in our country today. So I looked at that as a challenge and decided to embrace that challenge as I know how to write plays. And the result was Three Plays for America.
Wow. Well, I guess, and I also guess that I should have led with this, but where are you, based out of mainly for your,
Sure. So, I'm in Brooklyn. I've been in Brooklyn all this time. I earned a Master of Fine Arts in Playwriting from Columbia and, have been toiling away here in New York City ever since.
We do get a lot of New York playwrights, and it's always fun to kind of compare and contrast the Philly theater scene and the New York theater scene. And I'm finding there are less and less differences than I initially thought there were. I think it's it, there's definitely a difference between Philadelphia theater and New York theater, but I'm finding the commonalities are really starting to kind of come to the forefront now that I've had so much time to talk to playwrights.
Right, right. And, you know, I'm not surprised. I want to just add that I'm especially grateful that Elephant Room Productions showed an interest in this play because although it's set exclusively in Brooklyn, it does allude purposely and importantly to events in Philadelphia.
Well, since the conversation is gearing there already, why don't we just jump right in and chat about Three Plays for America, which as most ears readings go, I go into it as cold and as blind as I can. And I'm really glad I did with this piece because of how unique it was. So before we jump into our discussion, could you give the listeners just kind of a basic taste of what Three Plays for America is, and then just give us a little setup for the scene we're going to be listening to today?
Sure. So this play is a full-length work that comprises three shorter plays, each play having five scenes, and the plays are interconnected in terms of the thematic and even some of the character relationships, but also in terms of the order of the scenes. So the first play takes place in, all three plays take place in Brooklyn. The first play, Howard's Tavern, takes place in 1776. It's based on an actual event in the Battle of Long Island, also called the Battle of Brooklyn. The second play takes place in 2018 or 2019 in Brooklyn. It's called Neighbors. And the third play, called New Civil War, takes place in 2076, also in Brooklyn. So part of the fun for me was tracing a historic arc from 1776 through the present and into an unknown 2076 as it relates to Brooklyn. And I found myself through the work focusing on a central character who at this point has the same name in each of the three plays, although we discussed possible other approaches to that, but an African American woman whose name is Haney. And so the play became, in a sense, a discovery or an exploration of how one African American female sensibility changes over the course of American history, and how her presence, in turn, can change American history.
And can you just set up the scene we're going to be listening to today?
Sure. So we chose the first scene of the first play, Howard's Tavern. And in this play, it is nighttime, and we are in Brooklyn at an inn called Howard's Tavern. And in the middle of the night, there is a knock on the door by a pair of strangers, and before we know it, these strangers are involving the inhabitants of Howard's Tavern in a much larger and more important set of events than they could possibly have imagined.
All right, let's take a listen.
Scene one. In the darkness, we hear pounding on a heavy wood door. The noise continues for some time, stops for several long moments, and then resumes with greater insistence. A point of light appears in an upper region of the stage, and as it descends jerkily, we realize it comes from a dim illumination of an oil lamp held aloft by a middle-aged man wearing a loose jacket over his nightshirt, pants, and slippers, as he makes his way down a set of stairs.
All right, I'm coming.
He arrives at a lower landing, crosses to the far end of the room, unbolts a lock, and opens the front door.
Who is banging like a demon in the dead of the night?
Is this the inn known as Howard's Tavern?
That it is, just as it says on the placard hanging above your two heads.
And are you William Howard, proprietor?
Indeed I am. Who are you, come at this ungodly hour?
We're but weary travelers, my friend and I, seeking respite from a long journey.
You had no need to cause a ruckus, seeing as we keep a key on a hook outside right there in plain sight for such as you to enter and take shelter after all are asleep, in the English tradition.
I'm sorry to wake you from slumber.
What's done is done. Come in, come in.
He steps aside, allowing two men to enter, after which he closes and bolts the door.
Truth is, we normally don't get visitors so late.
The men, wearing coats and caps, come further inside and look around.
I'm surprised to hear you say that, situated as you are on a main road.
Folks coming through this part of Brooklyn are farmers and merchants, mostly on their way to and from more distant parts of Long Island. They travel by the light of day.
Mary Howard appears above the staircase holding a candle.
William, is there a problem?
Oh, no problem, Mary. Just two travelers without sense enough to see our key.
We're greatly sorry for waking you, ma'am.
Rouse up Haney and have her light the hearth so these gentlemen can be seen better than a lamp or two will provide.
Right away.
Mary exits.
Our rooms have all been let, but you can spread out here if you've the mind to do so.
The men glance at each other.
We're happy to oblige, although we could profit from a drink before we nod off.
A drink, eh? I've seen you before, but from your accents, you're... clearly, you're English.
We're all English, Mr. Howard.
I meant you are Are you gentlemen able to pay for the services you request?
The first man nods to the second man, who takes out a wad of bills, peels off a few, and leaves them on the table.
Does that allay your concerns, then?
British pounds still accepted here.
Haney Edgefield, a black woman, has come downstairs and silently gets to work by the fireplace.
Fine-looking nigger wench you got there, Mr. Howard.
Haney stops suddenly and turns, ready to reply in anger.
It's okay, Haney.
No, Mr. Howard, it ain't.
Right, of course. Haney is no slave, but free like the rest of us. Also, we do not use that word in this household to describe another human being, her being one of God's own creatures.
Once again, I apologize. This time for my companion. He meant no harm to you, Mr. Howard. Or you, miss.
Haney turns back to the fireplace as William Jr., 17, appears upstairs laden with a pile of blankets. Mother said you'd be needing these.
Leave them there, William, and bring these men a drink.
As William Jr. puts down the bundle.
Pint of ale to your liking?
Ale's fine.
Aye.
Coming right up. He exits to the back room. Others turn as a crackling of burning twigs sends out its glow, which slowly builds, illuminating the room.
Thank you kindly, Haney.
No need to thank me when it's what you pay me to do. These embers were still glowing, so it weren't no trouble.
Haney exits.
Gentlemen, make yourselves at home. Take off your coats.
We'll keep them on, if it's no bother. There is a chill wind outside, despite the warm season.
It's no bother to me either way. Well then, I expect my son will bring your drinks presently, and for you to spread out here. We have a privy out back, and there's breakfast in the morning that my wife prepares. Good night, gentlemen.
He starts away.
Mr. Howard.
Something more you need.
We could use some advice, if it please you. Seeing how we're strangers in these parts, and the colonies are disquieted and whatnot on account of troubles with the mother country, as they say, nowhere more so than Brooklyn.
What advice can I offer you?
Mostly it would help to know whether two Englishmen, such as ourselves, are safe in these parts.
Why wouldn't you be?
They say a declaration of American independence has likely been proclaimed in Philadelphia, and no doubt passions among common folks are running high.
You have nothing to worry about from common folks, long as you treat them fair and square.
Still, we hear George Washington, your leader, is camped with his army not far from here.
What of it?
William Jr. returns with two glasses of ale.
Ah, just in time.
To your health, good gentlemen.
Men toast and drink. I'll be upstairs if I'm wanted.
Abide a while, son.
Something more you need done?
Not at present, all the time. All the same, I'd like you with me.
As you wish, Father.
You were saying, Mr. Howard.
I weren't saying a thing. Your friend asked about General Washington and his troops, and I'm wondering why such matters are of interest to him.
Like I said, we're not known in these parts and worry we could meet trouble.
And as I told you, there's nothing to worry about. Gentlemen, I must ask you to leave immediately.
He takes money from the table and hands it back.
Why would you do that, Mr. Howard?
A man needn't explain his cause for desiring others off his property. 'Tis his God-given right and his right under law.
Still, it's late, dead of night, as you said, and we've been invited to stay.
That invitation is hereby revoked.
The men glance at each other.
I wish you would reconsider.
I'll do nothing of the kind. Not when you show up and start asking such questions, while the whole town knows General Howe of the Royal Army has landed ships on Staten Island and only this week begun to move troops across the Narrows into Brooklyn.
We heard that too, but that's at Gravesend Bay, many miles away.
William, bring down my musket. Make sure it's loaded.
Yes, Father. He starts off.
Just a moment.
William Jr. stops. The men put down their drinks.
There's no need for that, Mr. Howard.
Then you'll go.
I'll do one better.
He removes his coat to reveal a red tunic and shiny regalia of a British officer. Second man does the same. Father!
Allow me to introduce myself. I'm General William Howe, Commander-in-Chief of British Forces in North America. This is General Henry Clinton, and you're my prisoners.
Clinton removes a flintlock pistol from folds of uniform and levels it at Howard and William Jr.
And we're back! So the first thing I want to talk about with this play, and why I'm glad I didn't read it prior, was the title is delightfully misleading. Because when you hear three plays for America, my initial thought, I think any audience member's initial thought, is that you're going in to see three separate stories. So like Act 1, Act 2, Act 3.
Right.
But we have, you know, scene one, scene two. So that kind of, it jars you at first. And then I basically found that every time we got to a new scene, my mind instantly was able to shift into that world. I didn't find any problem. It wasn't as jarring as I think, yeah, some people might have found it. So I guess the first thing I want to ask is this your first piece kind of using this kind of broken up structure? And how does this relate to some of your previous writings?
So actually, no, this is not the first play that uses this approach. I wrote one other play called Five Plays of Dan McCrew, which is a one of my sequel plays, which is a response to a famous Canadian poem called The Shooting of Dan McCrew by Robert W. Service. And that play interconnected five shorter plays into a whole. And that play received some professional attention that led me to believe, again, that this is an approach, a method that I should really continue to explore. And when I set for myself this new goal of more directly engaging with the social and political situations in the country today, I fell back on this approach because I thought it would be useful, and I thought I do it. I thought I
well,
could.
Well, I mean, it's definitely
it.
it's definitely a unique challenge, and it's definitely I think once as an actor and once as an audience member, once you get your head around it, it really makes a lot of sense. But it throws you for a loop, and I think it's the good kind of throwing you for a loop because it's the kind of it tells you right away this is not going to be your average night of theater.
Right. And, you know, as I had mentioned before, we spoke about possibly changing the title of the play, among many other things, in order to entice a reader and hopefully an audience to enjoy the play. And not to be, shall I say, put off by the idea that maybe they're going to sit through 9 hours of theater, which
exactly.
is not the case.
Well, then, in terms of the structure of the play...
Yeah, I want to say one other thing about the... just one other thing about the title is that,
yeah.
You know, that title came to me, you know, I think I knew it may not be perfect, but the title, Three Plays for America, you know, after having had this breakthrough the year before as a playwright and then being given this new challenge of trying to write more directly to a larger audience... I did feel inspired to want to write for the whole country. You know, I'm here in Brooklyn, which is sort of at the edge of the country,
right.
And you know, very definitely part of, you know, more or less part of Blue America. And you know, you read the news and you're aware of current events. How can you not be these days? And so I felt like I wanted to make a strong statement through the play. Even if I didn't completely understand the ultimate meaning of the play, I had some sense that I should be writing with the whole country in mind. And I think that's a good inclination for a playwright. It's one of the, it's in a sense the first time I wrote from that sensibility, from that position.
Well, I think it's interesting though how a title, no matter what your thoughts on it in the long run, how a title can really jumpstart the whole process, and how whatever title you end up going with for this piece, I don't know that you would have the play that you have if you had not had that initial kind of thesis of Three Plays for America. I think I brought it up at the feedback, but if you actually go all the way back to the beginning of our catalog, the second episode of The Trumpet, our playwright Duncan Flaster, when I interviewed him, he had already changed the title between us doing the feedback and me interviewing him. So I was like, he definitely had that mindset of like, nope, this is a moving process and this is what works for the piece now. But I think for what it was needed for, I think it encapsulates what your story is and what the story was.
I think that's an insightful comment, and it's one that I really appreciate.
Oh, thank you. So next I want to ask about having the central character span these three different timelines. What was the initial inspiration to tell the story through, although it's not the same Haney, I do get the impression from the script that it should be the same actress in all three of these pieces, and it is the same name that we're going through. So what was the idea behind kind of telling a story through one character, quote-unquote's, eyes?
Right. So, you know, that idea, I think, developed as I was writing, and particularly as I was working the first two stories. The second story, Neighbors, is based on my experience living here in Carroll Gardens, Brooklyn, an old Italian-American neighborhood, which as of late, and more so as time goes by, is seeing increasing diversification in terms of, you know, race and religion, background, etc. So the idea of exploring what happens when a largely Italian-American neighborhood starts to incorporate Jewish characters, of which there's one in the play, Jewish people, of which there's one character in the play, Jews, of which there's one in the play, etc., was very, very interesting to me, especially because I have experience talking to my neighbors, you know, some old timers with very set beliefs, and some you know, newcomers with different beliefs. And so that was part of the inspiration, for writing the play. And along with that, as I worked with that first play, Howard's Tavern, which again, I said, is based on a real experience, historically, William Howard, the owner of the inn, did send one of his workers behind British lines, or I should say in front of British lines, to sneak up to Brooklyn Heights to warn General Washington and the Continental Army that there was going to be a rear guard attack on their fort. I chose to make that character African-American, again, thinking about it as I was writing the second play also. And then for the third play, which takes place in the future, it made all the sense in the world just to continue having that central African-American female character drive the action. And by doing that with the new Civil War, with that third play, you know, vistas of understanding in terms of what I was actually writing about opened up. And so I felt at a certain point that this was absolutely the right thing to do, that this character was a connecting and a defining character for this work as a whole.
Well, I think she definitely resonated with me, one of the most of all the characters, because, like you said, she has such a clear trajectory in all three stories. Even though one could argue in the third piece that she may not be exactly the central piece. There are a lot of moving parts in that third piece, not to give too much away about it. But she is still kind of right at the forefront. And I think it's really unique how you have made her a protagonist in all these plays, but each play kind of resonates with me in a different way. Like, it's almost like a different style. How did you decide on the structure? Once you got the structure of these are the three events that we're going to be talking about, how did you settle on the style of each piece?
Well, you know, that's a very interesting question. The style of the pieces were really determined in a sense for themselves, if you know what I mean. So if I'm writing a short play that takes place in 1776, as I started writing kind of contemporary New York, you know, linguistic locutions or whatever you want to call it, they just did not come to me. And what came to me was a kind of stylized language that I imagined could be the basis of this historic drama. Now, whether one of some of the feedback I got was that that type of language may itself need work, but I felt grateful while I was writing it that I had discovered a style for this historic drama different than something that I would write for the present. When it came to Neighbors, the play that takes place in the present, I did fall back on my experience writing sort of realistic, contemporary New York City characters, and had great fun with it. Most interestingly to me, New Civil War, the third play, became a sci-fi drama. And, you know, I found that the most challenging, and I was I found it very challenging, and I'm not convinced I hit the nail on the head or even if I hit, you know, wood anywhere near the nail. So, you know, part of the joy for me of hearing the play read through Elephant Room Productions was the opportunity to think about that. And then to hear the very, you know, considered and intelligent and creative responses to that play in particular from the actors. I think part of the challenge for that last play was, as with the historic play, to devise a style that was unique to the future and that made sense and that was thematically satisfying, if you know what I mean. You know, another issue that your questions brought to mind was the issue of a Caucasian man writing about an African American female character. And, you know, when Elephant Productions first contacted me, I remember in my email response mentioning that was a real concern of mine. And, so it's a reason I was happy to hear a larger issue of a diversifying country and the specific challenge for writers about writing across racial boundaries. And, you know, as I wrote and as I've lived now with this draft of the play, I've done research and I've read articles and books. And my feeling at this point is that, you know, I have every right to write whatever characters I want to write, but that it's certainly an imaginative challenge to write a female African American character in any historic setting, and that I have a particular moral responsibility to write, as I see it, truthfully about that character, as with the other characters. It's certainly something I need to be always cognizant of, about doing justice right to that character, whatever that means.
Well, I mean, I'm of the mindset that you are absolutely within your rights and within reason to write about a situation that does not directly relate to you, so long as you are approaching it from a place of respect and from a place of being well informed on it. And you know, this is this causes some ire in my community. I think I brought this up to you the other day, but it's something that it's always on the forefront of my mind whenever I see this discussion, because I see both ends of it. But as a gay man, I see the argument a lot that straight actors should not play gay characters. And I definitely see where the concern is. I think the concern is that sometimes we are overlooking gay actors who could bring these characters to life. But like I said, as long as you are approaching the character with truth and you're approaching the story with truth, I don't see any reason why you can't step into that role. And I kind of see the same thing in from a writing perspective. So I think you did your due diligence, you did your due research on these different eras, and I think you handled it very, very well.
Well, I appreciate that, and you know, I want to add one other thing from probably any artist's perspective, but certainly from the perspective of a playwright. I think you write the play that you need to write at that time, and you know, as I described in my opening remarks, things came together, strands of my life and my playwriting career. Came together in such a way where this idea presented itself to me through my own imagination, and I needed to follow through with it. There was no way I was not going to follow through with it. And so that points to the difference between a playwright living the life of a playwright, and a playwright living a life of theater. You know, I'm living the life of a playwright when I sit and follow my inspiration wherever it leads me, whether that process in this case or any other case leads to a life in the theater, meaning readings and productions or collaborating in any way with other theater professionals, is a different question, an important question, but a different one.
Absolutely. And like I said, you, as a playwright, I think that is a very, very strong stance to have. And I think that you have a very clear road ahead of you in terms of the stories that you are going to bring to the table, as long as you approach them from that mindset.
Well, thank you. And, you know, I do want to say again, your theater, the Elephant Ears reading series was an exceptionally singular experience for me. I've had other readings and I appreciate all of them. They can, I've learned that they can be very, very important in terms of hearing my work and discussing my work. This was different because I was present, as you had mentioned, but I stayed to the side. And
well, yeah, so let's sure. Touch to that for a moment. Like we said at the beginning, you know, as we've talked about on previous episodes, the general go ahead is we separate the play from the playwright, and we kind of have the impression that it allows the actors to be a little more free. But we've all done readings with playwrights, we've all done workshops with playwrights. So, you know, when we heard that you were coming, we all kind of mentally adjusted that, you know, this isn't going to be an adjustment at all. We're going to do the work that we always do, and we're going to have the discussion we always have. And, you know, honestly, having you there was such a different experience. But at the same time, it felt the same because, as you said, you sat to the side. We even ran the feedback, the discussion, as if you were not in the
right
room. And it was helpful for us to see, to kind of look over, even though we were kind of still in the world of the play. I would peek over during the recording, and I definitely saw you smiling at certain lines. I saw you jotting down notes at other lines. Describe the experience and how it differed from other processes for you, and what was so helpful
sure.
about our version.
So you know, as I've experienced it in typical reading after a stage reading of a play, which is what I've experienced, I sit on stage with the actors and director, and we have question and answer session between us on stage, between me and the actors, but also between us and the audience. And you know, it's really great because actors have insights. They have the best insights usually, and the audience from its perspective has great insights as well. In those circumstances, I generally find that it's incumbent upon me at a certain point to lead the discussion, to ask the questions, to direct a question either to the actors or to the audience. This experience with both in years was a complete reversal because I happily sat for, I think it was over an hour, listening to, you know, committed theater professionals discuss my play through a series of prompts and really hit, I would say, all of the important concerns I as a playwright need to have as I contemplate revisions. So I feel...
I can actually answer that question sure. for you right now. It was an hour and 4 minutes.
There you go.
I just pulled it up, yep.
So, you know, that, as I said, just was a singular experience, at least in my life, and I'm grateful for it, and I'm just, you know, I'm just so happy that I was able to participate in it, and, you know, having other professionals show attention to a play of mine makes me all the more want to pursue revisions. It's that excitement that I felt and the passion that I felt from the actors that kind of continues to live within me as I go forward.
And we were absolutely thrilled and honored to be able to give you that. So with that in mind, where does Three Plays for America go from here?
Well, I have purposely, you know, the reading was only a few weeks ago. I have purposefully let it settle. I'm planning in the very near future to type up the notes that I took. I was using, you know, the old-fashioned method, pen and pencil, pen and paper. So,
I know a playwright who, in his playwriting classes, will not allow laptops or tablets. You have to write on a tablet and a pencil because his thought is if you're typing, you're not writing. You're not putting thought
right.
into it. So I noticed that about you, and I respect
yeah,
that.
You know, and I insist on doing that because often when I'm taking notes, like in this case, I'm just struggling to keep up and to get all the nuances and the details down. It's when I can go back a few weeks later and type it up and really think about it as I go that the real helpful developments occur. So I'm planning to do that now that summer has kicked in. I'm planning to do that very shortly. And then I believe that I'm already almost at a point where I can, thanks to that experience, to this whole experience, that I can begin a revision. So that's where I am.
Nice. Well, I am very excited to either see or hear where this play goes next. I hope you will keep in touch and let us know the trajectory of this piece. But we are very, very happy to have been one of the first stops on the route.
I certainly will. And again, I just want to say thank you to you and to Elephant Room Productions for including me in this wonderful experience.
Well, before we wrap up, I appreciate that very much. Thank you very much. Before we wrap up, just to kind of wind things down on a fun note, just a fun little theater question to get your mind going.
Sure.
If you could move Haney to any other play, where do you think that she would make the most impact?
Do you mean any other play outside this play?
Any other play outside of this play, if you could take, and it could be any of the Haneys in this play, but... That I think her kind of spirit is consistent through the three Haneys.
A play by another playwright, are you saying?
Mm-hmm.
Wow, that's really a wonderful question. I mean, and the
I'm always good at like throwing in random gotchas at the end. So take as much time as you need to think on it.
So you know, just and in the spirit of my play and thinking about classic American plays, I'll offer three quick answers that actually I find quite amusing. I would love to see Haney show up in A Streetcar Named Desire.
Yeah, she would shut that down quick.
Yeah, I would like to. It would be very interesting to see Haney in Death of a Salesman. And also a different sort of play, Glenn Ross. You know, these are three plays that are at least, you know, written with exclusively with white cat. Well, except for a streetcar named Desire, where there are ancillary parts, one for an African-American actor. These are, you know, primarily almost exclusively, you know, they're almost exclusively, they deal with what are meant to be white characters. And so, you know, how does a character like Haney, what does she bring to the a world, to these worlds? And what does she, how does she change those worlds? And I'll just add one more in the spirit of looking at, you know, of like playing the devil's advocate to my own answer. What about Haney showing up in a real contemporary play such as Top Dog Underdog by Shrewsbury Parks, right? Thinking in terms not of her African Americanness per se or exclusively, but her feminine sensibility, you know, that entails, right? That there's a play of two brothers, a contemporary play in, you know, New York City. And, you know, they're involved in a kind of life and death struggle, literally a life and death struggle with each other. And I would be interested to see how Haney's female perspective could alter the fate of those two characters. Booth.
I will need to look up that play, because then that answer will have so much more parallels.
It's a good one.
I will add it to my list. well, Martin, thank you so much for coming on and talking with me today. To any other playwrights out there, just remember, we're always taking submissions. If you have a play to send to us for feedback in any form, please send it to, we're switching to a new email this month, submissions@elephantroomproductions.com. Since that's the first time, I'm going to say that one more time. submissions@elephantroomproductions.com. Remember, every story deserves to be heard, so join our elephant herd today. Until next time, this is Robert Jean Palleccio, signing off.